G'day, Francis here. Now, finding out accurate info about your rights at work and what wages you should be paid can be difficult. So why not give the Australian Union Support Centre a call? It's completely free and confidential, and the Support Centre is completely independent. Their number is 1300 486 466. 1300 486 466.
On the Job with Francis Leach and Sally Rugg.
It's On The Job, the podcast all about making your working life better. My name is Francis Leach.
And I'm Sally Rugg.
Don't you have to make a disclaimer of some sort so that people don't think that you're speaking on behalf of Globo Corporation and Hank Scorpio? Do you know who I'm talking about? You don't know
what I'm talking about. I don't know what you're saying.
Did you not grow up watching The Simpsons?
No, we weren't really allowed to watch TV.
Oh, we've had that conversation. Well, this is something we'll have to do for you at some point.
I think I do get the reference, but in any case, the disclaimer that
so you don't work for Hank Scorpio. That's the disclaimer.
My employer does not necessarily endorse the things that I could say on the podcast. I don't think I've said anything on the podcast that my employer wouldn't endorse.
But you could.
But it could, like, any moment, any day now, I'm going to say something really controversial.
That's what we're hanging in here for. Yeah. Hey, let's jump straight into our episode with Doug Rand in our COVID career series, because people have had to do amazing stuff while the pandemic has changed everybody's life, and they've made career pivots is the word, isn't it? Career pivot is the phrase these days, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Career pivot was to hang out with me. I don't know who's been smarter, Doug or you. But Doug's story is amazing. We're going to find out. I think we found, Sally, something special.
I think so.
Probably the only dual pilot / tram driver that you could ever meet. Someone who used to fly Big Bird's A380s in the sky and now, for a living, drives the number 86 tram up and down and around Melbourne streets, all in the space of 12 months.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. It shows a lot of initiative and adaptability. And, yeah, I'm looking forward to the chat.
Let's meet Doug. Doug, welcome to On The Job.
Well, Francis, thank you so much.
Okay, when did you first dream of being a pilot and flying?
Actually, I don't know if it was a dream as such. I was lucky enough in 1974, I went with my parents on a Qantas jetpower tour to Southeast Asia, to Singapore and Malaysia and to Hong Kong. On the way up, I went up to the flight deck of the 707, met the crew there. And then when we landed, it wasn't actually so much the aircraft that impressed me. It was that the captain and the flight engineer and actually stopped, remembered my name and said, "Doug, you know, have a great time. You're going to really love Singapore and you'll love Malaysia and you'll love Hong Kong. But remember, in Singapore, you've got to go to Fatty's. You've got to go to Sentosa Island. You've got to go and get some tiger balm and just a few other things like that." And it really stuck with me. And I was just so impressed that these people actually took the time to remember my name. And I remember turning to my mother and saying, "They're like demigods," which in retrospect is a pretty stupid thing to say. But
they were. I mean, pilots in the 60s and 70s, I mean, that was the coolest job you could have, wasn't it? It was, yeah. You were rock stars in a way.
Yeah. The impression I got, though, was that that actually probably didn't fit in with the ambitions of my my family. So I kind of dismissed it. I never thought about it again and just left it at that.
When did you first fly, though? Because it obviously was there. The pilot light was on to be a pilot. So when was your first flying experience?
Well, actually, the funny thing about starting flying is it was actually my dentist who convinced me to become a pilot.
Okay. Let's just take that in. What's the dentist got to do with it?
I'd been telling people for years I was going to become a dentist. There was expectations I'd probably go to university. I really had no idea what I wanted to do for a career. And dentistry was probably the lowest acceptable thing that would actually keep my parents happy. And I discovered every time that someone asked why would I want to become a dentist, just say, "Look, I want to use my brains and my hands." And that would shut them up. They'd never ask me again. And then my dentist asked me the same question, and the response was, "The hell would you want to become a dentist?" Which, from the dentist, I thought sounded pretty bizarre, to be honest. And then he convinced me. He said, look, I've got these mates. They're Qantas pilots. I drink with them out at the Royal Aero Club at New South Wales. They have a much better life than me. Why didn't you become a pilot? And it just started from there.
Fate knocked on your door at the dentist's office. Incredible. So you joined the Air Force at 21 years of age, which is a big step to take, and, you know, suddenly thrust into the world of the military to become a pilot. What was the training like? What was the, you know, the induction like to become an Air Force pilot, you know, back in, was it the early 80s you were doing this?
Well, even the Air Force was an accident, to be honest. I'd already done a commercial.
I don't like hearing my pilots talk about accidents. No.
I'd done a commercial pilot's license, and there are a lot of pilots out of work in the early 80s. A lot of people survived by basically flying for hours, food and board, in remote areas of the country, or they became flying instructors. And so if you didn't instruct, you didn't get paid, no matter how much you actually worked at a flying school. But anyway, that was the normal way of doing things at the time. I got a job as a flying instructor. I never actually taught anyone in the air, but I did teach on the ground for a couple of weeks, some people who had a sheep farm about 400 miles west of Sydney. And at the time, I'd applied to the Air Force simply because the examiner who checked me as a flying instructor was ex-Air Force and suggested that maybe I should try for the Air Force rather than teaching people to fly these tiny little aircraft. So I actually looked at it as you had to be 21 to be in an airline anyway, and I thought it would be a good opportunity to really have a bit of interview practice, thinking that the military would be more intimidating, possibly, the process, than joining an airline. So that's what I did.
For the next 12 years?
For the next 12 years, yes. I didn't see that coming.
Some amazing experiences as a military pilot?
I mean, I was kind of blessed from the beginning, because I actually wanted to fly maritime patrol aircraft, which most people would think is a little bit strange, to be honest. As it turned out, I was sent to the 707, which was primarily a transport aircraft, but also used for VIP work. So I got thrust very quickly into prime ministerial trips, into vice-regal trips, extraditions, some extraordinary places and extraordinary people that you would meet that most people would have no opportunity with. Challenging? Oh, well, I was in Mogadishu in Somalia for quite a few weeks, which I actually elected to do myself. And it was a ground-based job to actually help bring the Australian Army troops back from Somalia after they'd served over in Baidoa. And it was a real eye-opener. It was, we saw some fairly bizarre incidents there that gave you a bit of understanding why the Somali people were as upset as they were. There were people that I think felt let down by the UN, and then possibly felt that the only reason that we there were there as a police action was almost a recompense after the Gulf War, that we had to be appearing to do something for those people.
Now, you did become an airline pilot, which was always destined after your trip to Singapore. But I do want to read something from your psych report that you brought in, your psychological appraisal from the Chandler and McLeod Consultants, made in 1981 when you were a young man, which says here, you should be aware that your expressed interests are not in line with those normally expected of airline pilots, and also that your temperament is not at this stage one that would be considered for a position commanding large commercial aircraft. Well, I got that wrong. You operate most effectively as an independent pilot rather than one who is responsible for a team and for passengers. Yet, you flew for Qantas for how many years after you left the military? And Bob Christian, the man that wrote this appraisal of you, got this bit completely wrong.
Bob, I don't know if you should have mentioned his name. 24 years with Qantas. Yes.
24 years as an airline pilot.
Mm.
Did it meet your expectations? You know, did you feel like, you know, that little boy that got off the plane in Singapore was doing the job he thought he was doing, and, you know, and living the life of a pilot he thought he was meeting that day?
Yes and no, actually. Look, Qantas is a wonderful organisation, and I worked with some really talented and some really fabulous people. But I feel that we were given much more responsibility in the military at a very young age. And it's amazing when you give a young person a responsibility and you give them the trust that goes with that, just how much you can get out of them. So to a certain extent, because of the nature and the size of any airline, which is a very different type of operation, of course, there can be a tendency for some skill sets to be lost simply within the scheme of the hierarchy of the organisation.
And how did you go, you know, just adjusting to that life, being offshore, coming home, you know, never really being in the one place for a long time? I've always imagined that as a job, there'd be great advantages to that, but also there's a price to be paid by working in that environment, living that life.
Yeah, but there was more surety with it, to be quite honest. I mean, my wife, we've been married for 32 years, and certainly in the Air Force, I mean, I had days where I went away for a day trip up to Tyndall. And one of the things we used to always say is never leave home without a change of underwear, which was good because I spent the next 9 days doing flood relief out of Brisbane into places, you know, like Winton and Longreach and the like. And the same with the Air Force, you know, you'd be away for 5-6 weeks at a time, not necessarily knowing when the end date would be. Whereas in the airline, except for during September 11, you know, your schedule was your schedule. You knew how long you were away and knew how long you were at home.
What were the most enjoyable aspects of that job?
Oh, look, it was a privilege in terms of, I mean, I would go to London, say, 15 times a year. And, you know, if you can't enjoy London, you probably don't have a heartbeat, to be honest. And it really is a privilege. My daughter did 6 months over in Verona at university, and I was able to use my time when I was in London to race over, spend a night in Verona, catch up with my daughter and come back and still be back well in time, well rested to go back to work. So
it did still have that little tinge of the rock star life about it.
Yeah, look, it had the potential for that if you used it that way. Not everyone took advantage of that. But
you clearly loved what you do. You clearly loved, you know, flying big planes. And let's be a plane nerd now because you and I can do that. What was your favourite passenger jet to fly?
The 707.
Really?
Yeah.
The old vintage number?
Yep.
Why?
I don't know. There's just, it has so much character. It's a bit challenging. You get it right and it's very satisfying. You get it wrong and it bites back.
In what ways does it bite back?
I'll just leave it at that.
Don't bite again. Fair enough. What about the A380, the big Airbus?
Oh, well, it's an extraordinary aircraft. I mean, you're taking a whole village, basically, in one aircraft. And it's an extraordinary piece of machinery.
What's it like when that one takes off? What's it like when you pull the throttle back on an A380 and you're at the, you know, you're at the point of takeoff and that big hulking bird starts to crane into the sky?
Well, it feels surprisingly slow.
Really?
To be honest. And in fact, it has an extraordinary wing on it, which means you're really operating at speeds not dissimilar to a 737. So it's an extraordinary piece of engineering.
And which is your favourite airport to land at, and which one gave you the biggest problems?
To land at or to return to?
To return to.
Melbourne.
Melbourne.
Home.
Fair enough. Doug, you know, you clearly love what you do, but at the start of this year, you would have looked at your schedule and thought, another year on the road, I've got, did you know where you were going? Did you have a sort of like, do they plot it out for 6 months at a time and say, this is your series of flights, this is where you're going to be? Did you know that much?
Oh, look, it was pretty easy on the A380 because out of Melbourne, we didn't actually go to very many places anyway. So, and that was contracting as well. So, look, at that stage, I was more or less just going to Los Angeles and back and Singapore and back. In terms of the how far ahead, we'd know 8 weeks at a time what our schedule would be. But in all honesty, things were getting a little bit weird over in America. One of the strange things that they do over there, which I hope we don't do here, is they stick pharmacies in supermarkets. And because so many people are homeless, so many people are poor, so many people can't afford private insurance, they go to their pharmacist. Now, the idea that sick people go to a pharmacist in a supermarket and shop at the same time seems crazy to me. So as all this COVID stuff was rearing its head, you'd see this use of supermarkets that just made absolutely no sense. And I'm thinking this is just going to go pear-shaped.
So you got a real sense of that very early on from being
there. Early on. I mean, my last flight was on the 16th of March, and I'd been discussing this with people for quite some time before that.
Did you ever get the sense that it would be as dramatic a shutdown of your industry and so many others, but for the airline industry, like no planes in the sky? Or did that not really occur that would happen?
Look, in some respects, I'm surprised that took so long to shut down, especially in America. If you look at something like Flight Radar 24, you know, even months ago, the number of flights you see flying across the states is just extraordinary.
So that's like, if people don't know, it's an app you got for plane nerds like me and clearly Doug, where you can see, almost track every plane in the sky at any one time.
Yeah, absolutely extraordinary.
And did you start to see those diminishing it? Did you? Or?
Well, in certain parts of the world, but not in America. It took a long time for it to actually calm down there.
So that, in a way, was a good indication that they weren't getting the message, wasn't it?
Well, I would have thought so.
So you came home on that flight from Los Angeles on the 16th of March. You get off the plane, and what happened next?
Well, actually, I'll just step back a bit. You said having a sense of what was going to happen. I mean, I'd been fortunate enough. I'd read Michael Osterholm's book. The name escapes me right now, but it was written in 2017 about the possibilities of certain problems. And one of them was a pandemic, which he predicted, but he dealt with that more in the sense of a flu pandemic, not a coronavirus, as it turned out. But a lot of the aspects of it are not dissimilar. And it was almost like a script of what not to do, is what he was mentioning in it, that if you don't do this at this phase and you don't do this at the next, this is what would happen. And that's what was unfolding nightly on the news. And I was thinking, this is extraordinary.
So you were watching this unfold like the book you just read?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, terrifying.
Yeah.
When did you get word that you wouldn't be flying again? And how were you processing that for someone who'd done it, you know, for the better part of 40 years as your job?
Oh, well, I mean, as soon as we were stood down, it was obvious that a 500-seat aircraft wasn't going to be flying in a hurry. You know, I mentioned that to a few friends. I was, in the early days, I was saying, I can't see me going back to work till September. And everyone thought I was bonkers, to be honest. And then the indications from the company and from Qantas, that is, and then watching what other airlines were doing with their A380s in particular, like Lufthansa and Air France and whatever else, indicated that I wouldn't be flying certainly an A380 for a considerable period of time. Now, how long that will be, it's still up in the winds, and it just really depends what happens with the current response. But I was getting a sense that it was certainly going to be years at best.
How did that make you feel? And was there a sense of panic?
A sense of relief, to be honest. I mean, given that the two primary places I'd travelled to on the A380 were the UK and the US, and they seem to be the two basket cases at present, if I'm allowed to say that. I was quite happy not to go there, to be honest, as much as I love going there.
But professionally, you know, how did you cope with the idea of what am I going to do? What's work look like now? How am I going to pay for the things that I love and live comfortably as I have been if I don't fly airplanes around the world?
Well, actually, funnily enough, I approached my local member about that, who happens to be Josh Frydenberg. I sent him a suggestion regarding changes to access to superannuation. I sent it to Senator Hume as well. And I also sent it to Jim Chalmers. And the suggestion was they reconsider actually dropping the preservation age on superannuation back to 55, and also maybe even considering dropping the taxable rate back to 55, maybe to encourage people in that 55-plus age group to retire early and give a little bit of hope to younger people for their careers, specifically in aviation. Aviation's a very numbers-based environment, and seniority is everything in some airlines. And I figured I'd had it pretty good, to be quite honest, and I thought it was time to maybe put a suggestion forward that would give a bit of hope to people who haven't had the same good fortune to be able to have something to look forward to.
Did you get a response?
Oh, yeah, I got the standard response by a staffer who obviously didn't read what I wrote properly. Same with Senator Hume, and the response there was more or less just a cut and paste of some policy document somewhere that certainly didn't address what I raised as well. In the case of Jim Chalmers, he actually responded personally. He'd obviously read every word that I wrote, and I was quite impressed, to be quite honest. But he's not in government, so it's irrelevant.
You've embarked on a new career. You're a tram driver now.
I certainly
You've got am. To take me on that journey from the A380 lifting off at Tullamarine to getting in one of those big trams. What route are you driving in Melbourne? Are we allowed to know which ones you get around on?
Yeah,
or
look,
do they
I'm
mix a, it up a bit? Do you get to go a little bit of everywhere?
Well, yes and no. Look, the routes are determined on by the depot that you're based at. Now, I'm based at Kew Depot, which is walking distance from home.
This is even more and more bizarre, isn't it? After flying around the world for work, now you're just walking a couple of hundred metres down the road to the tram depot.
Well, it's even more bizarre than that, because if you think about it, the organisation I first joined was the Air Force, which was founded in 1921, and then Qantas in 1920. So, of course, they're celebrating their centenary this year. But the Kew tram depot alone, forget the network itself, but just the Kew tram depot dates back to 1915. So it's a little piece of history just sitting there quietly, pumping away, looking after Melbourne, or the Melbourne's east anyway, and just the most wonderful collection of people to work with. I've never met such a collection, such a diverse collection of people that seem to be devoid of ego and are just there to help and to welcome. It's just been one of the more pleasurable experiences of my life, to be honest.
How do you become a tram driver? Do you bring up the tram authorities and say, hey, are you looking for drivers? I used to fly A380s, so I know how to get people around. I'm sure I can do this.
Initially, actually, I was enjoying not working, to be honest. I had no desire to go packing shelves or anything like that, and it's got nothing to do with pride or anything. I mean, I used to pull dags off sheep's fleeces in shearing sheds out in Western New South Wales. So, in fact, probably the hardest I ever worked was in a shearing shed. So I'm not afraid of hard work, but I didn't want to go robbing other people of jobs where they probably desperately needed something when everything was falling apart. And I was fortunate enough that I actually had some savings that I could live for an extended period on, not indefinitely, but certainly there was no necessity for me to make any decisions in a hurry. But anyway, one day my dear wife Sarah was just looking through things and found a part-time job as a tram driver listed and suggested, why don't you apply for this? And I thought, actually, you know, I could do that. I like travelling in the tram. So I put the application in. That was the 22nd of April, and I didn't think anything of it, and I didn't hear anything until the 15th of September. And I get this, that 15th of September was the day I went in for an interview. It must have been the Friday before I received an email. And I got this email saying that I've passed the first part of the selection process, much to my surprise, and went in, had the interview. Next thing you know, I've got Zoom interviews with managers out of Kew. I'm then having security checks done. I had a incredibly thorough medical done. It was as thorough as the initial medical I had when I first joined the Air Force back in 1984. And within a month, I was actually on my tram driver's course out at Preston. It's quite bizarre. And not only that, it was the job was for a part-time job, but because I actually asked if it was possible to go to a Kew Depot, the answer was, well, they only have full-time employment. Would you like that? And I said, that would be wonderful. Thank you. So here I am, 57 years of age, starting a new career, getting a full-time job in a stage four lockdown. I mean, I'm indebted to Yarra Trams for, to be honest.
So you go out to start your tram career at the training base out in Preston. And what do they train you on? What I mean, you'd find that the 707, the 737, the military aircraft, are there trainer trams?
They have two tram simulators out at New Preston Depot. But no, we actually did our training in those beautiful big E-class trams, those Bombardier trams.
So they're the 1970s-style trams?
No, they're the...
Oh, the new ones.
The latest ones. Yeah, they're the ones with joysticks, like an A380, to be honest. It's just a beautiful piece of machinery. And they're proudly made in Melbourne.
Magnificent.
Made in Dandenong.
Australian-made trams.
Australian-made trams. Not an Australian company, but Australian-made trams. And they're a beautiful piece of kit.
What's it like to, you know, put the power behind that and just, you know, because it is touch. It's all about touch and sensory experiences in it. So you've, as I said, you pull the throttle back on an A380. So you're driving these E-class trams. How would you describe the difference? Because they're both powerful machines in their own way.
Well, the difference is in the case of an A380, you're working in a very controlled environment. You're working with people that are all licensed. people who are even the worst of them are trained at a very high level. In the case of a tram, you're spending 75% of your time on the roads with other drivers, with pedestrians, with all the distractions that a busy city can have, and a busy city that was in lockdown for quite a long time. So it's a very different kind of challenge.
Absolutely. I never thought of that. So when you've got this thing off the ground and you're flying, I guess, it's plain sailing. There's nothing in your way. No one's doing a hook turn in front of you. No one's cutting you off. No one's walking across the road. It's all just kick back and set the course for London. So this would have been, in a way, much more stressful.
It is. It's. I had an anaesthetist who described to me one day. He summed it up. He said, Doug, you and I basically do the same job. And I said, how do you figure that? He said, well, it's all about the takeoff or landing. In his case, it's putting someone to sleep and waking them up at the end of it.
Isn't that true?
And a lot of the rest of it is on autopilot. There's equipment there, there's beeping, there's lights, there's flashing, there's monitoring, there's doing things, there's checking things. And certainly when things start to go wrong, that's when you intervene, or that's when you start to go through your processes to keep everything safe. And I thought, what a wonderful analogy. An airline pilot is like an anaesthetist, but hopefully the airline pilot doesn't put you to sleep, I suppose.
So you've been doing it a while now, and I guess you've seen Melbourne come out of lockdown, so wake up a little bit as a tram driver. And I guess for the first time in a while, because pilots are sort of sequestered off, and rightfully so for security reasons, but now you see passengers get on and off. Some of them, if they're polite like me, will say thank you as they get on and off. You'll see all of life's rich pageant passing you by. What's that taught you about human nature and the way people behave?
Oh, I just think it's very real. I think it's just a privilege to be able to see the whole gamut of society, to be honest. I mean, in a lot of ways, a tram is like the football. It's one of the few times in any city where the whole range of society gets together in one place. I mean, certainly there are some people that don't catch trams, but then again, you probably don't see them at the football either, because they're probably locked away in a private box. But the rest of the time... I really see it as a privilege, to be honest.
And can I ask you about dealing with the traffic and dealing with those sorts of situations? Are you much more mindful now when you're out there about the power of the machine?
Oh, look, I must also point out, I've only just started doing this. I mean, in terms of the stage four lockdown, that's when I started my training, but the stage four had finished by the time I actually started getting trained on the road. And the other aspect is, although initially our training started on the E-class tram, so the modern one, at Q Depot, I'm on the A class, which is the big white shorter stumpy one that does the 109 and the 78 and the 48 runs.
So they are the old 70s trams.
Yeah, and they're brilliant. They're brilliant. I just love it.
Have you had a chance to get your hands at the controls of the old W class tram yet?
No, not yet.
Is that the dream?
No.
Because so many Melburnians, I mean, love those old things. But you just shattered my dream.
I haven't thought that far ahead.
So to sum up, this year's been an extraordinary thing for you. And I guess it's bookended, I guess, by going back out to the airport, as a civilian or as a passenger, or maybe even just to go out there to tie up loose ends with your old job. Mm. Have you been out there and in its silent, moribund phase, and how did that feel?
Yes, once. Technically, I finished with Qantas on the 6th of December, so I actually accepted a redundancy. I put my hand up fairly rapidly, to be honest. And unfortunately, when I went out to the airport, I actually accessed via the international terminal, which was probably not the best way to go in. I probably should have gone in by the Qantas domestic terminal, because it was really moribund. That's a wonderful description of how it felt actually going in via the international terminal. It was kind of gut-wrenching, to be honest. It was maudlin. Going in there. Once I got into the Qantas domestic terminal, there was life there, and it had that sense that things were coming back and there was some hope. So, and there certainly is.
There's some life now. It is fascinating, isn't it? Because I've often pointed out to people that look up in the sky, there are no planes flying. Could you have ever imagined a time in our lifetime that the skies would be empty? Extraordinary thing as an indication of just how profound the experience has been living through this pandemic.
Well, we've been told for so long that aviation is an essential service. I mean, we had a pilot's dispute way back when I was in the Air Force, actually, and ended up having to work harder than most of the contractors they brought in to during that dispute. You know, that the argument for an essential service for an airline these days, you'd have to question that if you can shut it down because of a virus. So,
Do you think there's a time soon when we'll be back in the skies? What are your old mates telling you about what their projections are, what they're feeling about maybe going back to work? Or is there just a sense now that it'll never be the same?
I haven't really been in touch with that many people, to be honest.
Yep.
And of the people I have kept in touch with, they've accepted redundancies as well. So,
but so there's a whole sort of generation of pilots who've now moved out of the industry.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's partly that sense also. You want a little bit of certainty in life. As I said, I mean, I'm 57 years of age. I don't want to sit around for another two or three or however many years wondering if and when life was going to start up again. Really, as much as I loved the job and had some wonderful people that I worked with, I just needed to move on. I mean, my whole career has just been chance, to be quite honest. Learning to fly was chance. Working in shearing sheds was chance. Ending up in the Air Force was chance. Ending up in Qantas. In fact, even when I applied for Qantas, it was that tinge of, if I don't apply now, I may regret it when I get older, because that's the reason I started flying. And I applied to Qantas and fortunately got in. And they've been a wonderful employer, but no regrets. And happy I've left.
And are you the only passenger jet pilot / tram driver currently working Melbourne's rails? Or are there others?
Oh, no.
There are others.
In fact, there were two of us on my course. There was a lovely young bloke, Ben, who was with Tiger. And he's at Q Depot as well. And there are certainly others. Oh, Andrew as well. He was Air New Zealand. He's at Q Depot. So, we've got a few pilots.
And has any of you guys yet said, welcome passengers, you're on the number 19 to North Coburg. The weather in Brunswick this afternoon is 20 degrees and we'll be arriving in about 30 minutes' time. I'll give you an update on the conditions as we approach. Please secure your tray tables. And
Look, I'm sure some of that happened with some of the first intake, to be quite honest, but no, you won't be hearing that from me.
If I do hear it, I know I've got an ex-pilot on board. Doug, it's been fascinating talking to you on the job about your extraordinary transition to your new career, and I look forward to touching on one of your trams very soon and taking a ride on one of those beautiful, big Australian-made trams.
Oh, look, Francis, thank you so much for having me on, and quite frankly, I was a little bit devastated that you even asked. You interview people like Tanya Plebisek and Lisa Alexander. The idea that you would bother spending any time with me, I found a bit bizarre, to be quite frank. But anyway.
No, your story is a great story. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Thanks, Francis.
There he is, Doug Rann, pilot and tram driver, and he loves doing both. Extraordinary things that people have done this year in a circumstance where they've found their work completely just disappear. Mm-hmm. And Doug's sort of taken on the challenge in a way that seen him, continue in the game, still getting people around, Sally.
Yeah, and I think there are several sort of live discussions at the moment in various industries about whether skills are applicable or not, right? And I'm thinking specifically now of jobs in coal and gas industries and looking ahead to their, likely shaky future, unfortunately, for those workers, and discussions around whether there are transferable skills that could be applied elsewhere. And I think Doug's story kind of shows that even if you're a specialist like a pilot, there actually are a bunch of really transferable skills and disciplines that can be used across industries.
Yeah, that's a really good point. We might do some more on that this year about the idea of recognizing what you've done in your working life. And often when you're in a specialized field, it's difficult to see or beyond your lane. Like, you've got the blinkers on in terms of your skill set, the work you do, what your networks are. And the idea of identifying what your skills are and how they might apply in an entirely different work environment or different sector can be very difficult to do, even though from the outside people might see that, you know, you, maybe it's your management skills or your analytical skills or even your hands-on skills, you know, with a bit of retraining are very, very much in demand elsewhere, but you just can't see it yourself. And I think that can be a bit of a hurdle for some people as they look at changing careers or are forced to change careers and get a little bit stuck.
It's an exciting thing to think about, and I'm sure a challenge that a lot of people are going to be facing in the years and decades ahead of us.
Good on you, Sally. Great to catch up again this week, and we'll do it again next week. Now, I remind people that if they want to give us a rating, they want to pump up our tyres so that we get to the top of the charts so that everyone finds out about who we are and what we're doing, they can do that by going to their favourite platform and giving us a rating.
That's right. Give us a review, give us some stars if you want to. It just helps other people find us. And so, like, when you're hanging out with friends and really want to talk about this amazing podcast you love called On The Job, chances are that some of the people you're sitting with might have also stumbled across it.
That's a good way to share it. Sally is on Twitter as well. Just search your name, Sally Rugg. I'm at St. Frankly, and we can talk to you there, and you can send us your 2K time trial results as well on your first day of work.
I'm not sending anybody my 2K time. I couldn't run 2K. No way. There's no way I could run 2K.
Dare to dream, Sally Rugg. Dare to dream. Good to talk to you. We'll catch you next week on The Job.
Bye.
On the job.